Our ship departs the hangar, silently floating forward into the vacuum of the dim, subcutaneous industrial world of Phobos. Pipes and loading docks and garbage bays as far as we can see. Closed off to the stars and the light of the sun, few ships as lovely as ours have ever flown so far beneath the surface of Phobos. The word low sector is rendered in white paint over an industrial transport hub where men pour into ships, and the ships trundle up out of this dim world toward the sector gates that the suns have breached. Our sleek yacht passes a motley fleet of slow-moving garbage haulers and freighters. Inside, men and women huddle quietly together in windowless, dirty steel cubes. Sweat drenches their backs. Their hands shake, holding unfamiliar instruments. Weapons. They pray they can be as brave as they've always imagined themselves to be. Then they'll land in some gold hangar. The sons will shout orders. The doors will open, and they will meet war. I pray silently for them, clenching my hands as I stare out the window. I feel Mustang watching me, measuring the tides deep within. Soon we leave the industrial stacks behind, trading the dim recesses for the neon advertisements that bathe the space boulevards of the mid-sector. Man-made canyons of steel to either side. Trams, elevators, apartments. Every screen connected to the web has been slaved by Quicksilver's hackers, showing images of Sevro and the Suns overrunning security gates and checkpoints, painting scythes on walls. And around us, the city of 30 million churns. Deep space commercial transports racing past little civilian taxis and skippers meant to go between the buildings here. Freighters soar from the hollows up through the mid-sector toward the needles. A flight of ripwings hunts through the streets above us. I hold my breath. With a flip of a trigger, they could shred us. But they don't. They register our high-color ship ID and hail us over the comms and offer an escort out of the war zone toward a current of yachts and skiffs that blaze quietly away from the moon.
Stirring speech.
Victor purrs over the ship's comm as I answer the call from Quicksilver's tower. Her bored voice at odds with the warring world around us.
Clown and Screwface just took Skyrush's main terminals. Rollo's men have seized the water cisterns for the mid-sector. Quicksilver's networks are broadcasting it all the way to Luna. Scythes popping up everywhere. And there's riots in Aegea, Corinth, everywhere on Mars. And we're hearing the same from Earth and Luna. Municipal buildings are falling. Police stations burning. You've woken the rabble.
They'll hit back soon.
As you said, darling. We massacred the first responders the Jackal sent. Got a few Bone Riders, just as we wanted. No Lilith or Thistle, though.
Damn. Worth a shot.
Martian Navy is on its way from Deimos. The Legions are coming, and we're making our final preparations.
Good. Good. Victra, I need you to let Sevro know that we've added a member to our expedition. Mustang's joined us.
Silence from her.
Am I on a private line?
Holiday tosses me a headset from the cockpit. I wrestle the headset on.
You are now? You don't agree?
Here are my thoughts. You can't trust her. Look at her brother, her father. Greed is in her blood. Of course she would ally with us. It fits her aims.
I watch Mustang as Victra speaks.
She needs us because she's losing her war. But what happens when we give her what she needs? What happens when we're in her way? Will you be able to put her down? Will you be able to pull the trigger?
Yes.
Victor's words linger as we pass Phobos's giant glass spires, cockpit skimming a dozen meters above the panes of the building. Inside, royal little worlds of madness. The rising has reached the needles in this district of the city. Low colors push inexorably through the halls, greys and silvers barricading doors, pinks standing in a bedroom over a bleeding old Gold and his wife, knives in hand.
Three silver children watching Ares on a wall-sized hollow as their parents speak in the library. And at last, a gold woman in a sky-blue cocktail dress, pearls about her neck, gold hair unbound to her waist. She stands near a window as Sons of Ares spread through the building, levels beneath her penthouse. Engulfed in her own drama, she raises a scorcher to her golden head, body stiff in imagined majesty. Her finger tightens around the trigger. And we're past, leaving her life and the chaos behind to join with the flow of yachts and pleasure craft that flee the battle for the safety of the planet. Most of the refugees call Mars home. Their ships, unlike ours, are not equipped for deep space. Now they scatter over the planet's atmosphere like burning seeds, most plunging straight for the spaceport of Corinth beneath us in the middle of the thermic sea. Others skimming over the atmosphere, disregarding designated transit lanes, racing past the Jackal's hastily erected blockade and the satellite level toward their homes in the opposite hemisphere. Ripwings and wasps from the military frigates flash after them, trying to herd them back to the designated avenues. But entitlement and chaos are a poor mix. Mania grips these fleeing golds.
The Dido.
Mustang eyes a glass ship, the shape of a sailboat, to our starboard.
Drusilla Auran's vessel. She taught me how to paint watercolours when I was little.
But my attention is farther out, where ugly, dark vessels without the flashing hulls or fanciful lines of the pleasure craft race toward Phobos. It's more than half the Martian defense fleet. Frigates, torch ships, destroyers, even two dreadnoughts. I wonder if the Jackal is on one of those bridges. Likely not. It's probably Lilith who leads the detachment, or some other praetor newly appointed in his regime. Antonia has been dispatched to aid Roke on the Rim. Their ships will be packed with lifelong soldiers, men and women as hard as we are. Many who fell in my Iron Reign. And they will cut through the mob I've summoned inside Phobos like paper. They'll be furious and confident. The more the better.
It's a trap, isn't it? You never meant to hold Phobos.
Do you know how the Inuit tribes of Earth killed wolves? Slower and weaker than the wolves. They chiseled knives till they were razor sharp, coated them in blood, and stuck them upright in the ice. Then the wolves would come up and lick the blood. And as the wolf licks, faster and faster, he's so ravenous he doesn't realize until it's too late that the blood he's drinking is his own.
I nod to the passing military vessels.
They hate that I was one of them. How many prime soldiers do you think those ships will launch at Phobos to take me, the great abomination, for their own glory? Pride will again be the downfall of your color.
You're trying to get them on the station because you don't need Phobos.
Like you said, I'm going to the Valkyrie Spires for an army. Orion and you might still have the remnants of my fleet, but we will need more ships than that. Severo is waiting in the ventilation system of the hangars. When the assault forces land to take back the military spire and the needles, they'll leave their shuttles behind in those hangars. Severo will descend from his hiding place, hijack the shuttles, and return them home to their ships, packed with all the sons we have left.
And you honestly believe you can control the Obsidian?
Not me. Him.
I nod to Ragnar.
They live in fear of their gods in the Board of Quality Control's Asgard station. Golds in suits of armor playing at Odin and Freya, same way that I lived in fear of the Greys in the pot, as we were cowed by the Proctors. Ragnar's going to show them just how mortal their gods really are.
How?
We will kill them. I have sent friends ahead months ago to spread the truth. We will return to my mother and my sister as heroes, and I will tell them their gods are false with my own tongue. I will show them how to fly, I will give them weapons, and this ship will carry them to Asgard, and we will conquer it as Darrow conquered Olympus. Then we will free the other tribes and carry them away from this land on Quicksilver ships.
That's why you have a Goridem armory back there.
What do you think? Possible?
Insane. Might be possible, though. Only if Ragnar can actually control them.
I will not control. I will lead.
He says it with quiet certainty. Mustang admires the man for a moment.
I believe you will.
I watch Ragnar as he looks back out the window. What passes behind those dark eyes? This is the first time I felt like he's not telling me something. He already deceived me by releasing Kavix. What else does he plan? We listen in tense silence to the radio waves crackle with yacht captains requesting docking clearance on the military frigates instead of continuing down to the planet. Connections are used, bribes offered, strings pulled. Men weep and beg. These civilians are discovering that their place in the world is smaller than they imagined. They do not matter. In war, men lose what makes them great. Their creativity, their wisdom, their joy. All that's left is their utility. War is not monstrous for making corpses of men, so much as it is for making machines of them. And woe to those who have no use in war, except to feed the machines. The Peerless Skard know this cold truth, and they have trained for centuries for this new age of war. Killing in the passage, struggling through the deprivation of the Institute, so that they might have worth when war comes. Time for pixies with deep pockets and expensive tastes to appreciate the realities of life. You do not matter unless you can kill. The bill, as Lauren often said, comes at the end. Now the pixies pay.
This is your last warning.
A gold praetor's voice cuts through the speakers of our ship, ordering the refugee ships to redirect toward authorized transit lanes and steer clear of the Navy warships, or they will be fired upon. The praetor cannot afford unauthorized vessels within 100 kilometers of her ship. They could carry bombs, could carry Sons of Ares. Two yachts ignore the warnings and are ripped apart as one of the cruisers fires railguns into their hulls. The praetor repeats her order. This time, it is obeyed. I look over at Mustang and wonder what she thinks of this. Of me, wishing we could be somewhere quiet where a thousand things didn't pull at us, where I could ask about her instead of the war.
Feels like the end of the world.
No. It is the beginning of a new one. I have to believe that.
The planetscape below is blue and speckled white as we pretend to follow the designated coordinates along the western hemisphere at the equator. Tiny green islands, ringed with tan beaches, wink up at us from the indigo waters of the thermic sea. Beneath, ships jerk and burn as they hit atmosphere before us. Like phosphorus firecrackers, Io and I played with as children, kicking spasmodically in glowing orange, then blue, as heat friction builds along their shields. Our blue veers us away, following a series of other ships who depart the general flow of traffic for their own homes. Soon, Phobos is half a planet away. The continents pass beneath. One by one, the other ships descend, and we're left alone on our journey to the uncivilized pole, flying past several dozen society satellites that monitor the southernmost continent. They too have been hacked into recycling information pulled from 3 years ago. We're invisible, for now. Not just to our enemies, but to our friends. Mustang leans from her chair, peering up into the cockpit.
What is that?
She gestures to the sensor display. A single dot follows behind us.
Another refugee ship from Phobos. Civilian vessel, no weapons.
But it's closing fast, trailing behind us by 200 kilometers.
If it's a civilian vessel, why did it just appear on our sensors?
It could have sensor shielding, dampness.
The ship closes to 40 kilometers. Something is wrong here.
Civilian vessels don't have that sort of acceleration.
Dive! Get us through the atmosphere, now! Holiday, on the gun!
The Blue slips into defense protocols, increasing our speed, strengthening our rear shields. We hit atmosphere. My teeth rattle together. The ship's electronic voice suggests passengers find their seats.
Thank you.
Holiday stumbles up, rushing past us to the tail gun. Then a warning siren trills as the ship behind us morphs on the radar display. Sharp contours of hidden weapons blossoming from its formerly smooth hull. It follows us into atmosphere, and it fires. Our pilot twists her thin hands in the gel controls. My stomach lurches. Hypersonic depleted uranium shells scar the canvas of clouds and icy terrain, superheating as they streak past. Our pilot continues to juke, twitching her fingers in the electric gel, face placid and lost in her dance with the pursuing craft, her eyes distant from her body. A single droplet of sweat beading on her right temple and trickling down her jaw. Then, a grey blur rips into the cockpit, and she explodes in a shower of meat, spattering the viewports and my face with blood. The uranium shell takes off the top half of her body, then rips through the floor. A second shell, the size of a child's head, screams through the ship between Mustang and me, punching a hole in the floor and ceiling. Wind shrieks. Emergency masks fall into our laps. Warning sirens warble as pressure rushes from our ship, whipping our hair. I see the blackness of the ocean through the hole in the floor. Stars through the hole in the ceiling as our oxygen leaks out. The pursuing ship continues to fire into our dying ship. I huddle in terror, with my hands over my head, teeth locked together, everything human in me screaming. Laughter, evil and inhuman, rumbles so loud I think it's coming from the buffeting wind. But it comes from Ragnar, his head tilted back as he laughs to his gods.
Alden knows we are coming to kill him. Even false gods do not die easily.
He throws himself from his seat and runs down the hall, laughing insanely.
Ragnar! Come back!
I am coming, Odin! I am coming for you!
Mustang dons her emergency mask and pushes the release on her safety webbing before I can gather my thoughts. The ship books, slamming her into the ceiling and the floor hard enough to crack the skull of any but an Oriot. Blood spills over her forehead from a gash at her hairline, and she clutches to the floor, waiting till the ship rolls again to angle herself so that she can use gravity to fall into the co-pilot chair. She lands, awkwardly, against the armrests, but manages to drag herself into the seat and buckle in. More warning lights pulse on the blood-drenched console. I look back down the hall to see if Ragnar and Holiday are alive, only to see a trio of shells savage the room behind us. My teeth clatter in my skull, gut vibrating with the champagne flutes in the cabinet to my left. I can't do anything but hold on as Mustang tries to arrest our fall through orbit. The seat's gel webbing tightens against my ribcage. I feel the G-forces crushing me. Time seems to slow as the world beneath swells. We're through the clouds. On the sensor, I see something small zip away from our ship and collide into the one trailing. Light flares behind us. Snow and mountains and ice floes dilate till they're all I can see through the broken cockpit window. Wind howls, shatteringly cold against my face.
Brace for impact! In five!
We plummet toward a sheaf of ice floating in the middle of the sea. On the horizon, a bloody ribbon of red ties the twilight sky to the ragged coastline of volcanic rock. A giant man stands atop the rock, black and huge against the red light. I blink, wondering if my mind is playing tricks on me, if I'm seeing Fichtner before my death. The man's mouth is an open, dark chasm into which no light escapes.
Dare tuck in!
Mustang shouts. I lower my head between my knees, wrap my arms around it.
3, 2, 1!
Our ship punches into the ice. All is dark and cold as we sink into the sea. Waters rushed in through the mangled back of the ship and gurgles through the dozen gaping holes in the cockpit. We're already beneath the waves, the last air bubbling out into the darkness. The crash webbing synced tight around my body upon impact, expanding to protect my bones. But now it's killing me, dragging me down with the ship. The water is freezing needles against my face. Sealskin protects my body, though. So I cut through the webbing with my razor, pressure building in my ears as I search frantically for Mustang. She's alive and already working on escape. A light in her hand carves through the darkness of the flooded cockpit. Her razor's out, cutting through her webbing like I did. I push myself through the flooded cabin toward her. The back of the ship is missing. 3 levels of vessel torn off and floating elsewhere in the darkness, with Ragnar and Holiday inside. My neck's locked up from whiplash. I suck at the oxygen from the mask that covers my nose and mouth. Mustang and I communicate silently, using the signals of grey lurcher squads. The human instinct is to flee the crash as fast as possible, but training reminds us to count our breaths, to think clinically. There are supplies here we might need. Mustang searches in the cockpit for the standard emergency kit, while I search for my equipment bag. It's missing, along with the rest of the gear in the cargo hold that we were bringing the Obsidians to seize Asgard. Mustang joins me, carrying a plastic emergency box the size of her torso, which she pulled from a cabinet behind the pilot's chair. Taking a last breath, we leave the oxygen behind. We swim to the edge of the torn hull, where the ship ends and the ocean begins. It is an abyss. Mustang turns off her light as I tie our belts together with a length of the crash webbing I took from my seat. Designed to keep the Obsidians trapped in their icy continent, the carved creatures here are man-eaters. I've seen pictures of the things. Translucent and fanged. Eyes bulging. Skin pale, worming with blue veins. Light and heat attract them. To swim in open water with a flashlight would draw things from the deeper levels. Even Ragnar wouldn't dare. Unable to see farther than a hand's breadth in front of us, we push away from the yacht's corpse in the black water, fighting for every agonizing meter. I can't see Mustang beside me. We're sluggish in the cold water, limbs burning as they claw darkness. But my mind is locked and certain. We will not die in this ocean. We will not drown. I repeat it over and over, hating the water. Mustang kicks my foot, disrupting our rhythm. I try to match it again. Where is the surface? There's no sun to greet us, to tell us we're near. It's wildly disorienting. Mustang kicks my leg again. Only this time, I feel the ripple of the water beneath as something large and fast and cold swims in the depths below. I slash down blindly with my razor, hitting nothing. Impossible to fight back the panic. I'm swinging at the darkness of the 2 kilometers of ocean that stretches beneath me and pumping my legs so desperately that I swim into the ice crust atop the water, almost knocking myself out. I feel Mustang's hand on my back, steadying me. The ice is dull grey skin that stretches above us. I stab my razor up into it, hear Mustang doing the same beside me. It's too thick to push clear of. I grip her shoulder and draw a circle to signal my plan. I turn so my back is against hers. Together, nearly blind and out of oxygen, we cut a circle in the ice. I keep going until I feel the ice give slightly. It's too heavy to push up without traction. Too buoyant to pull down with just our arms. So I swim to the side, so Mustang can savage the cylinder we've cut with her razor, mincing the ice enough to push the emergency box through first. She follows and extends a hand to aid me. I slash blindly back down at the darkness and follow her up. We collapse, head first onto the rock-hard surface of the ice. Wind rattles over our shaking bodies. We're on the edge of an ice shelf, between a savage coastline and the beginning of a cold, black sea. The sky throbs deep metallic blue. The South Pole locked in 2 months of twilight as it transitions to winter. The mountainous coastline dark and twisted, maybe 3 kilometers off. Ice stretching all the way, punctured by icebergs. Wreckage burns on the coast's mountains. Wind rushes in off the open water ahead of a coming storm, whipping the waves into calamity, so salt and spray hiss over the ice like sand buffeting through the desert. Water geysers into the air, 50 meters closer inland, as someone fires a pulse fist from underneath the ice. Numb and frozen, we rush toward Holiday as she pulls herself free, Mustang trailing behind with the emergency box.
Where is Ragnar?
Holiday looks up at me, face twisted and pale. Blood pools from her leg, piece of shrapnel sticking through her thigh. Her seal skin has kept her from the worst of the cold, but she didn't have time to don her suit's hood or gloves. She tightens a tourniquet around her leg, looking back into the hole.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I rip free my razor and stumble for the hole. Holiday scrambles in front of me.
Something's down there. Ragnar pulled it off on me.
I'm going down.
What? It's pitch black. You'll never find him.
You don't know that.
You'll die.
I won't let him go.
Darrow, stop.
She throws down the pulse fist and pulls Trigg's pistol from her leg holster and shoots it in front of my foot.
Stop.
What are you doing?
I will shoot your leg out before I let you kill yourself. That's what you're doing if you go down there.
You'd let him die.
He's not my mission.
Her eyes are hard, unsentimental and clinical. So different from the way I fight. I know she'll pull the trigger to save my life. I'm about to lunge at her when Mustang flashes past to my left. Too fast for me to say anything or for Holiday to threaten her. As she dives into the hole, a razor in her right hand and in her left, a flare blazing bright. I rush to the hole. Water laps peaceably at the edge. The ice is too thick to see Mustang beneath the surface as she swims, but the flare glows gently through the meter of dirty ice, blue and wandering toward the land. I follow it. Holiday tries to drag herself after.
Stay put.
I shout at her to stay and get the medkit for herself. I follow Mustang's light, razor skimming over the ice, tracing the light underneath for several minutes, till at last the light stops. It's not enough time for her to run out of breath, but it doesn't move for 10 seconds. And then it begins to fade. Ice and water darkening as the light sinks into the sea. I have to get her out. I slam my razor into the ice, carving a chunk free. I roar as I jam my fingers into the cracks and lift it up, hurling it backward over my head to reveal water churning with pale bodies and blood. Mustang bursts to the surface, crying in pain. Ragnar's beside her, blue and still, pinned under her left arm as her right hacks at something pale in the water. I stab my razor into the ice behind me and hold on to the hilt. Mustang reaches for my hand and I haul her out. Then we pull Ragnar out with a roar of effort. Mustang claws onto the ice, falling down with Ragnar. But she's not alone. A maggot-white creature the size of a small man has latched itself to her back. It's shaped like a snail in full sprint, except its back is tough. Hairy, translucent flesh mottled with dozens of shrieking little mouths, rimmed with needle teeth that gnaw into her back. It's eating her alive. A second creature the size of a large dog is stuck on Ragnar's back.
Get it off! Get it off!
Mustang slashes wildly as the creature, stronger than it should be, crawls back toward the hole in the ice, trying to drag her back to its home. A gunshot echoes, and the creature jerks as a slug from Holiday's bullet hits it square in the side. Black blood pulses out. The creature shrieks and slows enough for me to rush to Mustang and scalp the thing from her back with my razor. I kick it to the side, where it spasms as it dies. I cut Ragnar's beast in half, skinning it off his back, and hurl it to the side.
There's more down there, and something bigger.
Mustang struggles to her feet, and her face tightens as she sees Ragnar. I rush to him. He's not breathing.
Watch the hole!
My massive friend looks so childish there on the ice. I start CPR. He's missing his left boot, the socks halfway off. Foot jerks against the ice as I pump his chest. Holiday stumbles to us, pupils huge from painkillers, her legs bound with res flesh from the medkit. She collapses to the ice beside Ragnar, tugs his sock back on his foot, like it matters.
Come back!
Spit freezing against my lips. Eyelids crusty with tears I didn't even know I was shedding.
Your work isn't finished!
The holo tattoo is dark against his paling skin. The protection runes, like tears on his white face.
Your people need you!
Holiday holds his hand. Both of her is not equal to the size of the massive six-fingered paw.
Do you want them to win? Wake up, Ragnar! Wake up!
He jerks beneath my hands, chest twitching as his heart kicks. Water bubbles out of his mouth, arms scrabbling at the ice in confusion as he coughs for air. He sucks it down, huge chest heaving as he stares up at the sky. His scarred lips curl back into a mocking smile.
Not yet, oh mother. Not yet.
We're fucked.
We look over the meager supplies Mustang managed to scavenge from our vessel. We shake together in a ravine, finding momentary respite from the wind. It's not much. We huddle around the paltry heat of two thermal flares after having humped across the ice shelf as 80-kilometer winds shredded us with cold teeth. The storm darkens over the water behind us. Ragnar watches it with wary eyes as the rest of us sort through the supplies. There's a GPS transponder, several protein bars, two flashlights, dehydrated food, a thermal stove, and a thermal blanket, large enough for one of us. We've wrapped it around Holiday, since her suit's the most compromised. There's also a flare gun, a res flesh applicator, and a thumb-sized digital survival guide.
She's right. We have to get out of here or we're dead.
Our boxes of weapons are gone. Our armor and grav boots and supplies sunken to the bottom of the sea. All that would have let the Obsidians destroy their gods. All that would have let us contact our friends in orbit. The satellites are blind. No one is watching. No one except the men who shot us from the sky. The lone blessing is that they crashed as well. We saw their fire deeper in the mountains as we stumbled across the ice shelf. But if they survived, if they have gear, they will hunt us. And all we have to protect ourselves is four razors, a rifle, and a pulse fist with a drained charge. Our seal skin is sliced and damaged, but dehydration will claim us long before the cold does. Black rock and ice span the horizon. Yet if we eat the ice, our core temperatures will lower, and the cold will take us.
We have to find real shelter.
Mustang blows into her gloved hands, shivering.
Last I saw of the charts in the cockpit, we're 200 kilometers from the spires.
Might as well be 1,000.
Holiday chews her cracked bottom lip, still staring at the supplies as if they'll breed. Ragnar watches us discuss wearily. He knows this land. He knows we can't survive here. And though he will not say it, he knows that he will watch us die, one by one, and there will not be a thing he can do to stop it. Holiday will die first. Then Mustang. Her seal skin is torn where the beast bit her and water leaked in. Then I will go, and he will survive. How arrogant must we have sounded, thinking we could descend and free the obsidians in one night.
Aren't nomads here? We always heard stories about maroon legionnaires.
They are not stories. The clans seldom venture to the ice after autumn has fled. This is the season of the Eaters.
You didn't mention them.
I thought we would fly past their lands. I am sorry.
What are Eaters? My Antarctic anthropology ain't for shit.
Eaters of men. Shamed castouts from the clans.
Oh, bloody hell.
Taro, there must be a way to contact your men for extraction.
There isn't. Asgard's jamming array makes the whole continent static. The only tech for 1,000 kilometers is there. Unless the other ship has something.
Who are they?
Don't know. Can't be the Jackal. If he knew who we were, then he would have sent his fleet after us. Not just one Black Ops ship.
It's Cassius. I assume he came in on a disguised ship like I did. He's supposed to be on Luna. It was one of the positives of negotiating here. They get caught going behind my brother's back. It's as bad for them as for me. Worse.
How'd he know which ship was ours?
Must have sniffed out the diversion. Maybe he followed us from the hollows. I don't know. He's not stupid. He did catch you in the rain as well, going under the wall.
Or someone told him.
Holiday eyes Mustang darkly.
Why would I tell him when I'm on the gory damn ship?
Well, let's hope it's Cassius. If it is, then they won't just hop on grav boots and fly to Asgard for help, because then they'll have to explain to the Jackal why they were on Phobos to begin with. How'd it go down, anyway? It looked like a missile signature from the back of our ship. But we don't have missiles.
The boxes did. I fired a Sarissa out the back of the cargo bay from a shoulder launcher.
You shot a missile at them while we were falling?
Yes. And I attempted to gather grav boots. I failed.
I think you did just fine.
Mustang's sudden laughter infects the rest of us, even Holiday. Ragnar doesn't understand the humor. My cheer fades quickly, though, as Holiday coughs and cinches her hood tighter. I watch the black clouds over the sea.
How long till that storm hits, Ragnar?
Perhaps 2 hours. It moves with speed.
It'll get to negative 60. We won't survive, not with our gear like this.
The wind howls through our ravine and the bleak mountainside around us.
Then there's only one option. We sack up and push across the mountains. Find the downed ship. If it is Cassius in there, he'll have at least a full squad of 13th Legion Black Ops with him.
That's not a good thing. Those Greys are better trained for winter combat than we are.
Better than you.
Holiday pulls back her sealskin so Mustang can read the 13th Legion tattoo on her neck.
Not me.
You're a dragoon.
Who was? Point is, PFR. Praetorian Field Regulations. Mandate survival gear and long-range mission transport enough to last each squad a month in any conditions. They'll have water, food, heat, and grav boots.
What if they survive the crash?
Mustang eyes Holiday's injured leg and our paltry weapons supply.
Then they will not survive us.
And we're better off hitting them when they're still piecing themselves together. We go now, fast as we can, and we might get there before the storm lands. It's our only chance.
Ragnar and Holiday join me, the obsidian gathering the gear as the Grey checks her rifle's ammunition. But Mustang's hesitant. There's something else she hasn't told us.
What is it?
It's Cassius. I don't know for certain. What if... he's not alone. What if Aja is with him?
The storm falls as we climb along a rocky arm of the mountain. Soon, we can see nothing beyond our party. Steel-gray snow gnaws into us, blotting out the sky, the ice, the mountains inland. We duck our heads, squinting through the sealskin balaclavas. Boots scrape the ice underfoot. Wind roars, loud as a waterfall. I hunch against it, putting one boot after the other, connected with Mustang and Holiday by rope in the obsidian way, so we don't lose one another in the blizzard. Ragnar scouts ahead. How he finds his way is beyond me. He returns now, loping over the rocks with ease. He signals for us to follow. Easier said than done. Our world is small and furious. Mountains lurk in the white, their hulking shoulders the only shelter from the wind. We scramble over bitter black rock that slices at our gloves, while the wind tries to hurl us down gulches and bottomless crevasses. The exertion keeps us alive. Neither Holiday nor Mustang slow, and after more than an hour of dreadful travel, Ragnar guides us into a mountain pass, and the storm breathes. Beneath us, impaled upon a ridgeline, is the ship that shot us from the sky. I feel a pang of sympathy for her. Shark-like lines and flared starburst tail indicate she was once a long, sleek racing vessel of the famed Ganymede shipyards, painted proud and bold in crimson and silver by loving hands. Now she's a cracked, blackened corpse, impaled upside down on a stark ridgeline. Cassius, or whoever was inside, had a nasty time of it. The rear third of the ship sheaved off half a kilometre downhill from the main body. Both parts look deserted. Holiday scans the wreck with her rifle scope. No sign of life or movement outside.
Something seems off.
Mustang crouches beside me. Her father's visage watches me from the razor on her arm.
The wind is against us. I smell nothing.
His black eyes scan the peaks of the mountains around us, going rock to rock, looking for danger.
We can't risk getting pinned down by rifles.
I feel the wind pick up again behind us.
We need to close the distance, fast-like. Holiday, you lay cover.
Holiday digs a small trench in the snow and covers herself with the thermal blanket. We cover that with snow, so only her rifle's peeking out. Then Ragnar slips down the slope to investigate the rear half of the ship as Mustang and I press for the main wreck. Mustang and I slink low over rocks, covered by the renewed vigor of the storm, unable to see the ship till we're within 15 meters. We close the rest of the distance on our bellies and find a jagged hole in the aft where the back half of the fuselage was shredded by Ragnar's missile. Part of me expected a camp of war colours and golds preparing to hunt us down. Instead, the ship's an epileptic corpse, power flickering on and off. Inside, the ship is hollow and cavernous and almost too dark to see when the lights crackle off. Something drips in the darkness as we work our way toward the middle of the craft. I smell the blood before I see it. In the passenger compartment, nearly a dozen greys lie dead, smashed into the floor above us by the rocks that speared the ship as it landed. Mustang kneels next to the body of a mangled grey to examine his clothing.
Darrow.
She pulls back his collar and points to a tattoo. The digital ink still moves, even though the flesh is dead. Legio 13. So, it is Cassius's escort. I manipulate the toggle on my razor, moving my thumb in the shape of the new desired design. I press down. The razor slithers in my hand, abandoning its sling blade look for a shorter, broader blade, so I can stab more easily in the cramped environs. There's no sign of any life as we move forward, let alone Cassius. Just the wind moaning through the bones of the vessel. A strange feeling of vertigo, walking along the ceiling and looking up at the floor. Seats and belt buckles hanging down like intestines. The ship convulses back to life, illuminating a sea of broken data pads and dishes and gum packages underfoot. Sewage leaks from a crack in the metal wall. The ship dies again. Mustang taps my arm and points out a shattered bulkhead window to what looks like drag marks in the snow. Smeared blood, black in the dim light. She signs to me. Bear? I nod. A Razorback must have found the wreckage and begun feasting on the corpses of the diplomatic mission. I shudder, thinking of noble Cassius suffering that fate. A grisly sucking sound makes its way to us from farther on in the ship. We press forward, feeling the dread of the scene before we enter the forward passenger cabin. The Institute taught us the sound of teeth on raw meat. But still, this is a horrifying sight, even for me. Golds hang upside down from the ceiling, imprisoned in their crash webbing, legs pinned by bent paneling. Beneath them, hunch five nightmares. Their fur is grim and matted, once white, but now clumped with dried blood and filth. They gnaw on the bodies of the dead. Their heads are those of massive bears, but the eyes that peer through the eye sockets of those heads are black and cold with intelligence. Standing not on four legs, but two, the largest of the pack turns toward us. The ship lights throb back on. Pale, muscled arms, slick with seal grease to ward off the cold, dark with blood from skinning the dead golds, move from under the bare pelts. The obsidian is taller than I am. A crooked iron blade sewn into his hand. Human bones strung together with dried tendon as a breastplate. Hot breath billows from under the snout of the ursine skull he wears as a helmet. Slow and measured, the deep ululation of an evil war chant blossoms from between his blackened teeth. They've seen our eyes, and one screams something unintelligible. The ship wheezes, and the lights go out. The first cannibal vaults toward us through the cluttered hall, the rest behind him, shadows in the darkness. My pale razor lashes forward and hews through his iron knife, through his breastplate and clavicle, straight into his heart. I twist aside so he doesn't crash into me. His momentum takes him past me into Mustang, who sidesteps him and cuts his head clean off. His body spills to the ground past her, twitching. An audible grunt and a spear with a jagged iron end flies from one of the other cannibals. I duck under it and punch upward with my left hand, deflecting it into the ceiling, just over Mustang's head. Then, the obsidian behind slams into me as I rise. As large as I am, stronger, more creature than man. Overwhelming me with the frenzy of a lost mind, he pins me to the wall and snaps at me with blackened, sharp-filed teeth. The lights of the ship flash, illuminating the sores around his mouth. My arms are pinned to my sides. He bites at my nose. I turn my face just before he rips it off. Instead, his teeth sink into the meat at the base of my lower jaw. I scream in pain. Blood flows down my neck. He chomps down again, pulling at my face, eating me alive as the lights go out. His right hand tries to work a knife through the sealskin to slide it between my ribs and into my heart. The fabric holds. Then the cannibal goes slack, twitching as his body falls to the ground. Spinal cord severed by Mustang from behind. A black missile blurs past my face and slams into Mustang, knocking her off her feet. The fletching of an arrow sticks from her left shoulder. She grunts, scrambling on the ground. I lunge away from her, toward the three remaining obsidian. One's knocking another arrow. The second hefts a huge axe. The third holds a huge curved horn, which the cannibal brings through the bear helm to its mouth. Then, a terrible howl comes from outside the ship. The lights go out. The darkness ripples with a fourth shape. Shadowy forms lashing at one another. Metal cutting flesh. When the lights come back on, Ragnar stands, holding the head of one obsidian, as he pulls his razor out of the chest of the second. The third, bow cut in half, pulls a knife, stabbing wildly at Ragnar. He hacks her arm off. Still, she rolls away, mad, immune to pain. He stalks after her and rips off her helmet. Beneath is a young woman, face painted white, nostrils slit open so she looks a snake. Ritual scars forming a series of bars under both eyes. She can't be more than 18. Her mouth slurs out something as she stares at the vastness of Ragnar, large even for her people. Then, her wild eyes find the tattoos on his face.
Fear not,
she rasps, not in terror, but fevered joy.
Snakrur, Lafraesir.
She closes her eyes and Ragnar cuts off her head.
You prime?
I rush to Mustang, but she's already on her feet. The arrow sticks out from under her collarbone.
What did she say?
Your Nagal is better than mine.
I didn't understand the dialect.
It was too guttural. Ragnar knows it.
Stain the sun. Kill me. I will rise golden. They eat what they find.
He nods to the golds.
But to eat the flesh of gods is to rise immortal. More will come.
Even in the storm? Can their griffins fly in this?
The beasts do not ride, griffin. But no, they will seek refuge.
What about the other wreck? Supplies? Men?
He shakes his head.
Bodies. Ship munitions.
I send Ragnar to fetch Holiday from her post. Mustang and I stay with plans to search the ship for gear. But I remain standing, motionless, in the cannibal's charnel house, even after Ragnar slipped out into the snow. The golds might have been enemies, but this horror makes life feel so cheap. There's a cruel irony to this place. It is terrifying and wicked, but it wouldn't exist unless gold made it exist to create fear, to create that need for their iron rule. These poor bastards were eaten by their own pet monsters. Mustang stands from examining one of the obsidian, wincing from the arrow that's still embedded in her shoulder.
Are you all right?
I gesture to the broken fingernails on one of the golds.
They weren't dead when they started skinning them. Just frapped.
She nods, sadly, and holds out her palm. Something she found on the obsidian body. 6 Institute class rings. 2 Pluto cypress trees. A Minerva owl. A Jupiter lightning bolt. A Diana stag. And one which I pick from her palm. Emblazoned with the Mars wolf head.
We should look for him.
I reach up to the ceiling to examine the golds who hang upside down from their seats. Their eyes and tongues are gone, but I can see, mangled as they are, none are my old friend. We search the rest of the upside down ship and find several small bedroom suites. In the dresser of one, Mustang finds an ornate leather box with several watches and a small pearl earring set in silver.
Cassius was here.
Are those his watches?
It's my earring.
I help Mustang remove the arrow from her shoulder in Cassius's suite, away from the gore. She makes no sound if I break off the tip, push her against the wall, and jerk the arrow out by its tail end. She curls in on herself, slumping down to her heels in pain. I sit on the edge of the mattress that's fallen from the ceiling and watch her hunch there. She doesn't like being touched when she's wounded.
Finish up.
I use the res gun to make a shiny patch over the hole on the front and back, just under her collarbone. It stops the bleeding and will help repair the tissue, but she'll feel the wound and it'll slow her for days. I pull her sealskin back up over her bare shoulder. She zips the front up for herself, before patching the wound on my jaw as well. Her breath fills the air. She comes so close I can smell the dampness of the snow that's melted in her hair. She presses the res gun to my jaw and paints a thin layer of the microorganisms onto the wound. They scramble into the pores and tighten to make a flesh-like antibacterial coating. Her hand lingers on the back of my head, fingers wrapped in the strands of my hair, like she wants to say something, but doesn't have the words.
You in there?
Nor does she find them by the time Holiday and Ragnar return.
Reap!
Hearing Holiday calling my name, I squeeze Mustang's good shoulder and leave her there. Most of the ship's gear is gone. Several sets of optics missing from their cases. The armory missing entirely, scattered across the mountains as the ship came apart and the cargo hold ripped open. The rest has been torn through by obsidians or broken in the crash. All I get is static from the transponder and comm gear. Ragnar discerns that Cassius and the rest of his party, some 15 men, departed several hours before we reached the vessel. They stripped it bare of supplies. The eaters likely descended as soon as it landed. Otherwise, Cassius wouldn't have left those golds behind to be eaten. Supporting this idea, Mustang finds several eater bodies nearer the cockpit, which means Cassius and his men were under attack as they left. Snows almost covered the corpses. We stack the fresher bodies outside in the snow, in case worse predators than eaters come to visit. After scavenging the ship for supplies, I have Mustang and Holiday seal us inside the galley, fusing the two entrances shut with welding torches found in the ship's maintenance closet. The weapons and cold gear might have been stripped clean, but the ship's cistern is full, the water inside not yet frozen, and the galley's pantries are stocked with food. It's passingly cozy in our shelter. The insulation traps our heat inside. The light from two amber emergency lamps bathes the room in soft orange. Holiday uses the intermittent power to cook a feast of pasta with marinara sauce and sausage over the galley's electric stoves, as Ragnar and I plot a course to the spires, and Mustang sorts through the stacks of scavenged provisions, filling military packs she found in storage. I burn my tongue as Holiday brings Ragnar and me heaping portions of pasta. I didn't realize how hungry I was. Ragnar nudges me, and I follow his eyes to watch quietly as Holiday brings Mustang a bowl too and leaves her with a small nod. Mustang smiles to herself. The four of us sit, eating in silence, listening to our forks against the bowls. The wind shrieking outside, rivets groaning. Steel-gray snow piles against the small circular windows, but not before we see strange shapes moving through the white to drag off the corpses we set outside.
What was it like growing up here?
Mustang asks Ragnar. She sits cross-legged with her back against the wall. I lay adjacent to her, a backpack between, on one of the mattresses Ragnar dragged inside the room to line its floor, on my third serving of pasta.
It was home. I did not know anything else.
But now that you do?
He smiles, gently.
It was a playground. The world beyond is vast, but so small. Men putting themselves in boxes, sitting at desks, riding in cars, ships. Here, the world is small, but without end.
He loses himself in stories. Slow to share at first, now it seems he revels in knowing that we listen, that we care. He tells us of swimming in the ice floes as a boy, how he was an awkward child, too slow, bones outracing the rest of him. When he was beaten by another boy, his mother took him to the sky for the first time on her griffin, making him hold on to her from behind, teaching him it is his arms that keep him from falling, his will.
She flew higher and higher, till the air was thin and I could feel the cold in my bones. She was waiting for me to let go, to weaken. But she did not know that I tied my wrists together. That is as close to All-Mother Death as I have ever been.
His mother, Alia Velaris, the Snow Sparrow, is a legend among her people for her reverence for the gods. A daughter to a wanderer, she became a warrior of the spires and rose in prominence as she raided other clans. Such is her devotion to the gods that when she rose to power, she gave 4 of her own children to serve them, keeping only 1 for herself, Sephi.
She sounds like my father. Poor sods. Mama would make me cookies and teach me how to strip down a hoverjack.
And what about your father?
He was a bad sort, but bad in a boring way. A different family in every port. Stereotypical legionnaire. I got his eyes. Trig got Ma's.
I never knew my first father.
Ragnar means his birth father. Obsidian women are polygamous. They might have 7 children from 7 fathers. Those men are then bound to protect the other children of her brood.
He went to become a slave before I was born. My mother never speaks his name. I do not even know if he lives.
We can find out. We'd have to search the Board of Quality Control's registry. Not easy, but we can find him. What happened to him, if you want to know.
He's stunned by the idea and nods slowly.
Yes, I would like that.
Holiday watches Mustang in a very different way than she did just hours before when we were leaving Phobos. And I'm struck by how natural this feels. Our 4 worlds colliding together.
We all know your father, but what's your ma like? She looks frigid, from what I've seen, just on the HC, you know.
Oh, that's my stepmother. She doesn't care for me. Just Adris, actually. My real mother died when I was young. She was kind, mischievous, and very sad.
Why?
Holiday.
Her mother is a subject I've never pushed. She's held her back from me. A little locked box in her soul that she never shares. Except tonight, it seems.
It's all right.
She pulls up her legs, hugging them, and continues.
When I was 6, my mother was pregnant with a little girl. The doctor said that there would be complications with the birth and recommended intervening medically. But my father said that if the child was not fit to survive birth, it did not deserve life. We can fly between the stars, mold the planets, but my father let my sister die in my mother's womb.
The hell? Why not give her cell therapy? You got the money.
Purity in the product.
That's insane.
That's my family. Mother was never the same. I'd hear her crying in the middle of the day. See her staring out the window. Then one night she went for a walk at Carrickmore, the estate my father gave her as a wedding present. He was in Aegea working. She never came home. They found her on the rocks beneath the sea cliffs. Father said she slipped. If he was alive now, he'd still say she slipped. I don't think he could have survived thinking anything else.
I'm sorry.
As am I. It's why I'm here, since that's what you were wondering. My father was a titan, but he was wrong. He was cruel. And if I can be something else...
Her eyes meet mine.
I will be.